Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to this O'Leary Report Don Cox of Cox Advisors. Don has many decades of very extraordinary experience in the investment world. He's based in Chicago. His global strategy, commodity strategy team advises several commodities funds, both in Canada, in the United States, and internationally. And he's just launched a new strategy service, which is outstanding. I've just had a chance to, Don, to read your new strategy journal and look at some of the webcast transcripts. And his, I can't recommend his journal and webcasts enough. You can learn more at coxadvisors.net. So, Don, welcome to the O'Leary Report.
Pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, one of the things I thought you covered, we want to talk today about both the Fed taper and commodities, but one of the things I think you covered very well in your new strategy journal is what the consequences of the Fed taper, Fed policies and quantitative easing is on the economy and what some of the risks are. And maybe we could start there and talk about what the extraordinary injection of Fed intervention is doing in the markets and what it's doing to investors and what you think it means to the commodities markets.
Well, I'll begin by telling you 3 years ago I was speaking at a conference in Denver, and the speaker before me on the line was David Dodge, who had recently retired as governor of the Central Bank of Canada, and followed by Mark Carney. And we had known each other not that well for quite a few years because I've been in Ottawa so much. And he spoke first, and he said that what had been done by the central banks was extraordinary, but it was important that they go back to conventional monetary policies as soon as possible because of the potential particularly inflationary risks of continuing to make injections on this scale and having these zero interest rates. So while he was talking, the analogy occurred to me. And so when I spoke next, I said, my father was a doctor in the Canadian Army in World War II in the Italian campaign, and he did more battlefield anesthetics than any other Canadian doctor, for which he received a citation. And he said that for the severely wounded soldiers, what they absolutely had to have was heroin. That was the only anesthetic that worked. But he said it didn't take any skill to give them the heroin. The skill came in withdrawing them from heroin and putting them on to morphine or another analgesic as soon as possible, because if they stayed on the heroin, they would become addicted and their lives would be destroyed. And too many occasions of that did exist. So then I paused. I said, zero interest rates are financial heroin. And David Dodge's head snapped, and he said, that is a great analogy. That was 3 years ago. We're still there. Now, what is financial heroin? What it is it makes you feel good. And one of the things you certainly don't want to do is take on risks. And so what we've seen is that the S&P just keeps going to new highs, along with record highs for short-term borrowing for stocks. I call it the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers routine. They go up absolutely perfectly together. Well, the other thing that happens with this is that we have the approach that the way in which you value companies is not on the basis of long-term, because the crash took away the idea that there was a long-term we could count on. And so what we have is that companies must not be trying to tell their stockholders, we have a 5 to 7 year plan and we've got capital spending for this. No, they're saying, you got cash in the treasury, so pay us higher dividends and buy back stock. Well, that was an agreeable thing for managements because they all have stock options. So what they discovered was something that made them rich and satisfied stockholders, and the stocks performed well on the basis of doing this. but none of this has anything to do with capitalism as a system where risk is done to assume rewards with a longer-term vision, and that is the essential dynamic of capitalism. So what we are doing here is operating a system for which we have no precedent, which is one for insiders and current investors who are very short-term in their orientation. And so should we be surprised that we're only getting 2.25% economic growth? Well, if you take risk from the system, you're not going to get more economic growth.
Right. We, I think the S&P was up 29% last year. Companies with major buyback programs were up 45% on the S&P. So it made an enormous difference. And my calculations show that if you add the buybacks to dividends on the S&P, they're paying out about 80% of their earnings. So that's, you know, how can you have major reinvestment? One thing I thought you did a great job in the journal of pointing out is how much of this, though, is being financed with borrowing cheap money. So we have corporations really driving profits up from, from borrowing and reengineering their balance sheets, not from doing anything that contributes to the general economy of the country or the world.
What Apple did, where they had the most sought-after bond sale of last year, $450 million that they raised, and not one dime of it was to be invested in the business. All the money was being done to pay dividends and buy back stock. So here was the company that has sort of defined the changes that have occurred in our world, leading to revolutions in the Arab world and all of this. And then that was before we got the announcement at their meeting in which the CEO announced that they're going to be devoting more of their energy to fighting climate change. Well, that's a nice thing if each personally a member of the National Resources Defense Council and wants to block Keystone. That has nothing to do with creating great new products.
Right. I couldn't agree more. Well, one of the things that I think was surprising for many of us, me included, was we, coming out of the beginning of the century, we had something called the commodity super cycle, which I'd love for you to explain. And yet we saw, of course, during 2008, we saw commodities take a nosedive, then come back into 2011, but has been dropping ever since despite the quantitative easing. So maybe if you could talk about the commodity super cycle and what's been happening. Are we still in a commodity super cycle?
Well, thank you. The commodity super cycle came after the end of a 21-year triple waterfall crash. I wrote a book about that called The New Reality of Wall Street. And so if you go back to the 70s, which is when I came into the business, what you had was a commodity boom led by the quadruple price of oil, which was done not so much by oil demand increasing, but by OPEC, and to punish the Western nations for supporting Israel. Those were extraneous events. But when you had a quadruple price for oil, we got and central banks printing money, what we had was double-digit inflation. So it took Paul Volcker in this country and Margaret Thatcher in Britain to come up with the tough monetary policies and high real rates to knock down particularly the price of gold, taking it, which had gone from $35 an ounce to $800, and also to take the inflation fear right out of the system. Meanwhile, what had happened was a lot of capital spending was launched on the basis of ever-rising commodity prices. So it took two decades to finally get out of that system, and we came into this new millennium. And what struck me, and I started writing about it in 1999, is we got a whole new set of commodity buyers. The Chinese, they haven't figured in this, but China is now ready to re-enter the world after 500 years after the Emperor of China stopped having their ocean shipping going around the world. They had actually circumnavigated the globe before Magellan. And he said, no, our fleet will be kept here. So China chose to stay at home. And they, of course, got fouled up with wars, invasions, and then the various European countries carved up parts of China. And the most important single travel event of the last century was in 1978, Deng Xiaoping visited Britain at the behest of the Labour Party to see how the working classes were being devastated under capitalism. Well, he drew exactly the opposite lesson. He couldn't believe how well off they were with their city housing, and they had cars and television sets. So he came back and he made a small editorial change in the signs of Mao Zedong everywhere, which is to work is glorious. He changed it to be rich is glorious.
Wow, I didn't know that.
It took quite a while for this to work through the system, but I was studying this and I realized their economic growth rate had been double digit right through the 90s, which meant that we had more than a billion people who'd gone from not being part of the global economic system because their average caloric intake was 950 calories a day, and they were coming up over the 2000 mark. And what I knew was, I had formerly been head of the Ontario Federation of Agriculture and general counsel of the Canadian Federation of Agriculture. I knew that there just wasn't enough grain and food being produced. I could also see that there wasn't much chance of copper and iron ore being produced from what we had. So it was apparent to me that one of the things that the commodity collapse had been related to was also demographic decline across the industrial world. Because with each new generation arriving and reaching, let's say, age 21, it was 40% smaller than the previous generation. So that meant there would be no embedded increase in commodity demand. So what we needed was a couple of billion more consumers. So I said, we're getting them. And since my father had been born and raised in India, and I was a fan of India, and Manmohan Singh had, when he was finance minister, finally dealt with a license rash, I said, we've got 2 billion more consumers, and we don't have enough commodity supplies. So I proclaimed in February of 2002 the birth of the greatest commodity boom of all time. Radical view at the time, for which I was ridiculed, but it unfolded. And then we had the crash. Now, the crash was not a commodity crash. It was a financial crash created by what I call the big bad bonus bailout bankers. And so, on the other hand, when you destroy the financial system, what you do is you certainly cut down demand for everything. And by that time, a lot of capital spending had been launched. And when you open a new mine, it takes, 7 years or so. So what happened was a lot of CapEx, which was planned in the years 2005 and 6 and 7, didn't come on stream until after the crash. So it gave people the false sense then that the commodity boom was over. Well, the fact remains that people's incomes were rising, not just in China and India, but Indonesia, same thing. They passed the 2,000 calorie point. So therefore, the fundamentals of what had given us the first wave of the commodity super cycle were in place. All that we needed now was to see that those economies continued and that the capitalist economies, after coming out of the crash, would revert to normal economic growth. We didn't get the second part of that because of the financial heroin. So we've had slower economic growth, therefore slower overall growth in commodity demand. But the fact remains that we bottomed out a long time ago in the commodity indices. And so what we have then is a situation where now they are rallying. And only a week ago, finally, the CRB Futures Index climbed up through its 200-day moving average. And so you look at the rally that we've seen in gold, triple-digit prices for oil, record prices for coffee. Here and there, what we're seeing is demand outrushing supply. So we, although it's not going to look as easy as it did the first time, because that occurred at a time of strong economies in the industrial world, plus insatiable appetites from these emerging economies, we have those appetites are now somewhat satiated, but we know that people then want to maintain their lifestyles. So there will be more demand for food and foodstuffs, more demand for metals. It will not be as robust as the first time. Chris Patten, 2 years after I said that, he was the last governor of Hong Kong, said for the first 17 centuries of what we call the Christian era, more than half of global GDP was in China and India.
Right.
They did not experience the Industrial Revolution. They fell back. He said in this century, they will resume, and by the middle of the century, they will have more than half of global GDP. That means that they are going to be consuming more and more commodities. He's right.
Right. It's interesting. There, over a billion smartphones were shipped last year. So we now have, I think, 1.8 billion people on smartphones. And that, you know, all those people are coming into the consumer society and the consumer economy. So I'll never forget one of the best description I heard of what the phenomenon you're describing. I was at the gold conference in New Orleans, and somebody asked Jim Rogers if he was concerned about peak oil. He said, "Forget peak oil; it's peak everything."
Yeah, I mean, the only place in which we've had a boom in CapEx has been in fracking in this country. And the right. oil and gas exploration industry is behaving like true capitalists. And if it
That's
weren't
true.
For the growth we were getting from that and the reduction in energy costs that we're getting from that, our growth wouldn't be much more than that of the Eurozone.
Right. Although I do see a fair amount of reinvestment now starting in manufacturing with the gas price coming down as low as it has.
Yes.
There's a lot of investment in high automation areas, manufacturing being one. So I'm hopeful, and of course, continued investment in agriculture. Well, one of the things I thought was very interesting, you pointed out the different obstacles China has to becoming sort of a world power again. The biggest one being, of course, they don't have a navy. They just launched their first aircraft carrier. But I thought it was interesting your discussion of their assertion of military rights in the South China Sea and the concern that they become a military force as well.
That is scary because there is, unfortunately, no precedent for a new major economic power coming on the scene to challenge the existing entrenched things without it leading to a war. And so the most recent example was, of course, when Bismarck united the German-speaking parts of Europe to create Germany. And after he'd moved along on this and was industrialized following Britain and the United States, then he decided it was time to get a navy. And as we know, what that did was scared the British enough so that they started building dreadnoughts, and they entered into a fateful treaty with Russia and France then, aimed at Austria-Hungary and Germany. And what triggered that then was that when the Germans invaded Belgium, which was guaranteed neutral, the war that nobody wanted occurred. But if this was the first time Britain had entered into a permanent treaty of protection with a continental power, Britain had always managed to stay back. And so But the reason Britain did this was because they were getting scared by the growth in the German Navy. And when they opened the canal in Heligoland, which meant that they could get out of the North Sea and into the North Atlantic, that changed the dynamics of Britain's safety behind the Straits of Dover. So that British fear was one of the things that led Britain to abandon its centuries-old policy. And because the French were so satisfied and the Russians that they could guarantee that Britain would join them in the war, then we had World War One. With China, what you see now is that they built up a huge army, but only recently have they really developed the Navy. And right. That challenges the U.S. Seventh Fleet.
Right, and I assume that's why we're pivoting and moving more of our fleet out to Asia.
Yes, well, it's of course always difficult with this president to know. After all, he reset with Russia, and that really turned out well. And so he's changed his plans for his trip to Asia, the one that he postponed because he said he had to stay because of the sequestering battle in Washington. Actually, just sat in the White House through this. It was worked out by the Republicans finding Democrats to work with. But he didn't turn up the Asian conference. And then he said, well, he's coming back in the spring. He's only going to spend one day in Japan. And that's where the treaty comes into effect, because U.S. has the treaty with Japan to defend it if it's attacked, which includes the Sakako Islands. And the possibility then of the U.S. being dragged into a war that it doesn't want, because China thinks right now, certainly seeing what's happening in Ukraine, that Obama is not going to do anything more than give the occasional speech, they might make a miscalculation. That's worrisome. I mean, at some point, the reason why Hitler was so convinced that he could go into Belgium and start World War II was, but when he started, he invaded, or Hitler went into Poland, and he said there's no way that the British government is going to honor its treaty with Poland. He didn't allow for the fact that Neville Chamberlain resigned in the government to be replaced by Winston Churchill. He thought there would have to be a British election. He didn't realize the British parliamentary system meant it could be changed by the party in power. The next example of that was when the Tories dumped Margaret Thatcher without an election.
Right. Right. I was going to ask you what you thought had happened in the Ukraine, because certainly when it comes to commodities, the Ukraine is an extremely important area, and what we see is Putin insisting on protecting his warm water ports.
Well, we shouldn't be as surprised as we were by this, but it's because Obama is so preoccupied with trying to do a deal with Iran, and he's getting, quotes, cooperation from Russia, that he took his eye off the ball. And what Putin is using is a principle which was introduced, oddly enough, by Woodrow Wilson at the end of World War One, which was the rights of peoples to be protected. Up until then, it was nations to be protected. Hitler picked up on that, and after his supposed deal with Neville Chamberlain, he went into the Sudetenland to protect Sudeten Germans from the other Germans there. That was the next example of applying this rule that we can protect our own nationals in another country. So Putin is going back to the same rule that Hitler used, which is to say, well, the German-speaking Ukrainians are under attack from these fascists, quotes, and so we are exercising our historic right of protecting Russians in territories where, after all, we sent them there. Stalin sent those Russians into these parts as they were adding them to Russia. And he did that to make sure that they couldn't cause him a problem. So it's the descendants of those people that were forcibly moved out of Russia into Ukraine that now are calling for help from Mother Russia. So stage one is the Crimea. We will know how serious he is, whether the next move he makes is to take Odessa, which will give him both Black Sea ports, and he will then have a chokehold on Ukraine.
Right. Right. Well, it's certainly going to be interesting. Let's turn to Japan, because I heard you speak at the Casey conference last fall, and you gave the most compelling argument in support of the Japanese equity markets and sort of took me by surprise. I hadn't heard it before. So maybe if you could talk about why you're so, you have so much confidence in the Japanese economy and the Japanese equity markets.
Well, aside from foreign policy things, which are a rather newer concern, what I did was I looked at the fact that Japan had might be completing its triple waterfall crash. I kept looking for the end of it, and it took about the same time as the commodity crash. It took 21 years. And what had happened, amazingly enough, was that at a time that they were the worst performing of the industrial economies and they had the worst demography in the industrial world, they had the strongest currency. The yen had gone all the way up to 75. When I came into this business, the yen was 450 to the dollar. So the idea that Japanese companies were still alive and competing with a hopelessly overvalued currency meant that once they dealt with that, that they would be formidable competitors. That was stage one. Secondly, the Japanese had been changing governments over the last 15 years, about like the Italians. And this time, Abe won, and then he also won the upper house. This was new, because even Koizumi, who had given me some hope for this, was never able to get both chambers. So he eventually gave up. He was the only new liberal, shall we say, force in Japan, and he failed. So I looked at what Abe was doing, the three arrow quivers, and I said, wait a minute, this is familiar. So I went back and looked at Japanese history from 1929 to 1935. During that time, Japan was the fastest growing industrial power in the world. By far. How was that done? They had a finance minister named Takahashi who came up with a program, and it started, the first thing which was to devalue the yen, took it off the gold standard. Secondly, he did budget deficits, and he found all sorts of ways of stimulating capital spending. He dealt with improvements for agriculture to make Japan self-sufficient in food. He had a full-scale program, and I looked at it, and I said, Abe is taking a script for something that worked for Japan. And because the Japanese have such a sense of their own history, they recognized that this is the first time that a similar set of policies were being brought in. It happened that an ancestor of Abe's at the time after World War I was one of the founders of the Social Democratic Party in Japan, which was successful enough to prevent the communists from taking over Japan. And so the Japanese love to see lineage and power. There were three premiers previously with the name Abe. So he had the right blue blood. He was using a proven formula from Japanese history when Japan became such a formidable power. And he reached back into the Japanese soul. And he also, unfortunately, opened a part of the soul that would have been left alone, which was their military.
The military.
And so yeah, that's what we're at right now. And I hope that he decides that he's done enough on that front. But the result is that you have these Japanese companies, and it was the fact that they were able to survive at 75. So the one-third devaluation of the yen has meant that these companies are having the fastest profit increases in the industrial world. And this was the worst stock market in the industrial world for 20 years. And analysts on Wall Street had given up even following Japanese stocks. So it was a pretty easy call to make.
Right. One of the things that really struck me at the end of the year when we looked back and did our analysis of the different equity markets is that most of the rise of the S&P was explained by just an expansion of PEs, but a majority of the expansion of the Japanese market was explained by profits. And I hadn't expected that. I had not expected such an extraordinary difference between the two. And you were the guy who got me to get off my prejudice and take a look.
Well, look, there's no question. I have had a lot of that pushback from people. I've had a lot of pushback from people on that call on Japan because there's a lot of people who family members who suffered terribly under the Japanese. And so, and the other thing, they kept coming back with, look, they've done nothing for 20 years, and so why would it be right this time? It's because he had a playbook, and he had a playbook that the Japanese population could respect, and they realized this time something serious was being done, and they started unzipping their wallets.
Well, it's interesting. I also did a little review of innovation last year, and I was looking at who's developed the leading applications in three areas. One was fabrication technology, one was composite materials, and one was robotics. And I kept coming back to clusters of Japanese companies, and it was extraordinary the extent to which, you know, we were buying back stock over here, and they were investing in very hard, important developments.
So, you see, that's what it's interesting, Catherine, because if you think about it, that these Japanese companies, those policies were put in place at a time when their survival was at stake because of their wildly overvalued currency, and therefore they had to find new ways of doing it. So what they were doing was they set in place these policies of making themselves more excellent than their competitors because of that. And so now they have everything going for them because their currency is better valued, and they have done the work and the research, and they've done the investment in this. So they are great companies now.
One of the things that I thought you did a great job in the journal of was talking about the extraordinary impact on the Western economies from both, sort of overregulation plus a response to the corruption, certainly the corruption in the financial system. And so you describe a population, at one point you call us war weary, because of course part of it is we've had the campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, as you said, added $6 trillion to the national debt and, you know, basically had a miserable experience. And so you've got a very weary population, and yet, that weariness is going to hurt us again. And at one point you discuss what the sort of how the Fed policy contributes to this, and you talk about what the Fed could do that could start to withdraw the heroin in a way that might help turn that population around. And I wanted to ask you about that. What could we do?
Well, the first thing we got to do is got to get rid of the zero interest rates. That's the pure heroin. What's being done at the tapering end is a separate question. Everybody focuses on that. And I was interested. The Henry Kaufman last week in the Wall Street Journal doubled me up on it. I said that what they should do was immediately raise short-term rates to 50 basis points, because at the moment, the irony is that the people who caused the crash have profited from it, because they're able to borrow from the Fed at 3 basis points and lend the money back to the Fed at 25 basis points. That's what they're doing. The bank reserves.
Right. It's just free money.
Yeah.
It's not free borrowing. It's free profits.
Yeah, free profits. I mean, you're making 8 times the money with no risk. And so that the bank reserves are created every time the Fed at the tapering end buys a bond or a mortgage back, it creates bank reserves. Now, according to Milton Friedman's theories, that money would be then used to make lending, and you get the multiplier effect. But when you just lend the money back to the Fed, All you do is you create profits for the very organizations that caused the crash. This is preposterous. It's as if after World War II, we designed a system that said that the people we're going to reward the most to get a recovery in Germany are those that caused the war.
Well, many, many of the smaller bankers I know say the pressure is really on from the regulators for them not to lend. In other words, they want the money in their investment account buying long treasuries and long Fannies and Freddies so that, you know, they're really under the gun not to put the money out on Main Street.
Yes, and this is an example of what happens when you have regulation getting out of control, because they're trying to prevent these banks from going bust. But the bank crash was not a question of Main Street banks going down. It was the big bad bonus bailout banks. And so what you want is the Main Street banks making loans. So the Fed was given the job in the 1990s of reinforcing the Community Reinvestment Act. And what they did was, and Chicago is the one where I have the experience, was they would look at where banks were making loans north in the north end of the city, and they weren't making mortgage loans down on the south side. And so the Fed would, in the Fed examination of the Main Street banks, they devoted the biggest part of their energy to reinforcing their Community Reinvestment Act. And so Fannie and Freddie twinned up with that and said, okay, the banks are worried about taking these mortgages. We will take them on. And Fannie and Freddie grew. And the banks, as a result of making these loans, they wouldn't keep them themselves, but they were thereby allowed to merge and allowed to pay dividends and do things. But they couldn't do that unless they were shown to be not discriminating against people. So there was an example where the regulations, which were set out with a good moral principle in mind, but they got out of hand. And so then Fannie Mae got taken over by ex-Democrats like that had been in the Clinton administration. And they made fabulous amounts of money. The lady lawyer, whose name for the moment escapes me, made over $100 million in a few years coming out as an executive of Fannie and Fred. And she would go out to their conferences and say, we want more subprime loans. Beautiful.
See, now, I think you're being way too nice here because actually in 1994, my company was the lead financial advisor of the Federal Housing Administration. And if you mapped out where the originations were, FHA had the basically the subprime neighborhoods. They'd traditionally been the insurer credit provider in those neighborhoods. And FHA promulgated a new affordable housing policy, which basically required Freddie and Fannie to start doing much more in the same neighborhoods. And what was interesting is if you looked at FHA's strategic plan in 1994, they were predicting that they would significantly increase originations in those neighborhoods. And they were then working with Freddie and Fannie to also get Freddie and Fannie into those neighborhoods in a big way. And I said to the controller when I looked at the plans, I was privy to the FHA strategic plan, and then I saw the affordable housing, and I said, wait a minute. You know, there are not enough houses or people to do this many mortgages. People are going to have to, because they were taking up their private prisons and arresting everybody in the war on drugs. I said, people are going to have to refinance their mortgage two times a year for prison to make these numbers. And she turned to me, Don, and she said, shut up. This is none of your business.
Wow.
So it's there's a deeper story here.
Okay.
And I will tell you when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, it was in Chicago I first saw it. You had neighborhoods where literally a house would be refinanced five times in 1 year. You know, and it's a whole nother story what was really going on. But this is, this is the financial fraud is a much more, and I think that's one of the reasons you see Americans who are so war weary, because it's, you know, it's so out of control and in your face. I will tell you, Chicago was the city that when I was commissioner caused me the most trouble. And one of the reasons was the head of your housing authority came to me and said, We were financing some new construction and rehab at Cabrini Green, and the cost was $250,000 per unit. And he said, look, you know, I can buy and rehab a single family home for $50,000 to $75,000 in the same neighborhood. Let me take the money and I can get three or four homes for the price of one. And what we discovered was under the law, we couldn't do that. I tried to get the laws changed and couldn't, and then tried to do it again in the when we came back in as the lead financial advisor. And I took the, and in fact, Chicago was one of the places where I was able to document a four-block area. If we could move money around within a place, we could save a fortune for the taxpayers, get a much better result for, you know, sort of win-win for everybody. And I took it to the assistant to the person who ran the public housing, and I said, look at all, you know, we in Chicago, New Orleans, all these places, we can get four houses for the price of one. And the assistant looked at me and said, but how could we generate fees for our friends? Well, that's one of the great opportunities, America, Don, is if you could subject places to a place-based optimization and find a way to solve politically the fees for your friends, which is, it's a more complicated, it's not just a moral issue, there are all sorts of serious business issues as well, but if you could do that place-based optimization, there is, in fact, a way to re-engineer the federal budget that could save a lot of money for taxpayers and be much better for the economy. Because I agree with you. I think that the combination, at one point in the journal you said, the addition of, or maybe you're quoting somebody, the addition of Euro-style regulation has soaked up a lot of the benefits of the stimulus, and I think that's fair.
Oh, yes, because this is something that can be done without having to go to Congress, you see. And you can, after all, Obama's training was as a community organizer in the South Side. And so what he's an expert at is seeing how you use power to promote these kinds of things you don't have to do through legislation. So the amount of regulations, remember that it was only 3 years ago that the guy in charge of the Dallas office of the EPA came out and bragged and produced a movie in which he said, my policy of dealing with the frackers is I use the policy the Romans used in Israel. You crucify a few people and the rest of them get the message. And well, anyway, there was such a rebellion in Congress on that he's gone to one of the tax-exempt organizations. But that was their basic mindset, was that fracking had to be bad. Well, if fracking hadn't boomed, we would be in serious trouble. So that was one case where they were able to stop the regulators. But and now we've got 10,000 pages of regulations coming with Obamacare. And that's because of the other group that is a real problem for this country, is the tort lawyers. Well, you know, at the time that the Obamacare was first being introduced in Congress, the Republicans said they would cooperate on the drafting of legislation, providing that Obama continue the development of Bush's policy of tort reform. And Obama said, I'll do that. Then the bill came. Nothing was done on tort reform because one of the five top funding groups for the Democrats were the plaintiffs' lawyers. And they saw that this was going to be heavy regulations of doctors and hospitals and caregivers. And they suddenly saw this is going to be better for us than the tobacco things were. Because right. Hospitals that don't bulk up and staff and understand the regulations, we can bring these cases against them. With 10,000 pages of regulations, hospitals are getting rid of medical staff and hiring legal and accounting staff to keep up with it. Now, there is an example of regulation just going out of control, but it's all about control.
Right. Well, so what's happening is, and this was why I left Washington, you have all these different forces behind centralization. And one of the things they all agree is creating toll booths centrally is good for them, and markets are bad. And yet the absence of markets is what's killing economies. I'll never forget, I was working on a plan to do venture funds that would allow, you know, with new technology, there's tremendous opportunity to aggregate different functions for small business and create, you know, the equivalent of mutual funds or venture funds for a community, particularly REITs where you turn around places. And so, and the capital gains opportunities, you know, is not small at all. And I never forget, I had lunch with the general counsel to one of the authorizing committees in Congress, and he said, look, private equity capital is not to flow into these neighborhoods at all. You know, we will allow capital go in through low-income housing tax credits, but that's a decision that's been made. And they're basically saying, you know, no market economies and no market capital on Wall Street. On Main Street, you know. And so it's shutting down one of the most entrepreneurial part of the economy and the part of the economy that was creating new jobs. So,
It's Neil Ferguson's book is wonderful.
I saw your reference to it. I haven't read it, but it sounded very interesting.
Book, but he spoke in Chicago when the book came out last summer, and I was in the audience. I've known him not well, but for quite a few years, and he stunned the audience with what he was saying about what was happening to the society because of regulation being the fastest growing industry.
Right.
And so it's I was at a conference also in Chicago where representatives of the European Union were there and with their forecast for the coming year. And so I got up and asked a question. I said, you haven't mentioned energy policy. And I said, in this country, fortunately, the fracking boom came because the states have been able to do the regulation on it, not Washington. That got driven away. And so we've had this boom, and if it hadn't been for that, our economy wouldn't have grown much more than yours did. And so I said, but meanwhile, look at your policies in Europe. I said, France has the sanest policies, and Germany's energy policies are absolutely insane. Well, the three Europeans there just burst out laughing at that. And they all three replied to me, and the British representative said, well, where it comes to energy regulation, he says, I'm going to use Mr. Cox's expression, I'm in favor of federalism in Europe. So, we were lucky, but that's the point is that that's the only industry that went through massive deregulation in this period.
Right.
Everybody else has been subjected to more regulation. So why should we be surprised? And then when you can make the money so easily by just buying back your stock and borrowing money at near zero cost, why take the risks and why have to retain the lawyers to fight?
Right. If you can rig it through Washington or rig it through the Fed, why bother? There's one other thing I wanted to cover before we close, and that is you had several references to the LNG export policies, and I've never been able to figure out what I think is going to happen there. Are we going to become an exporter in a major way using LNG? I would love for you to just give us an overview of what's happening and what you think is going to happen.
What I talked about was that there's a whole bunch of applications in line, but what we've got here is that the big business community, the one that represents them all, is deeply divided on this because the electricity companies and the chemical companies are saying, no, don't export this cheap gas. This is the best competitive advantage we've ever had. That's the chemical company saying, because European chemical companies are coming and opening up new plants here because they're getting natural gas at 4.25, and in Europe it's $10 an MCF. And so there's that, and the electricity companies are saying, look, we're being forced off coal, And we'll do that because we've got cheap gas, so we get it's a low cost fuel, and we win all these credits. So we've got, therefore, the business community is divided about free trade in gas, And so there's the one project that's been approved. There's six more in line to be approved, all in the Gulf. And so we have the chance to be big-scale exporters of liquefied natural gas. Now, liquefied natural gas doesn't land in Europe at 4.25, but it does land in Europe at around $9, and it's not going to go up from there. So, and also it takes them off reliance on Putin. And they understood that even before most recent events, that that's a good thing.
Right. I would think the recent events would have certainly encouraged them to be a little bit more concerned.
You bet.
Well, we have to.
We
have to. Before we close, we have to talk about the road ahead for commodities. Let's maybe look at oil and gas, and then agricultural commodities, and of course to our old friend precious metals.
Okay. Well, as far as oil and gas are concerned, I think that in the case of oil, we got low triple-digit numbers there, but a lot of that is due to concerns about what's happening in Ukraine right now. We're getting enough production, and we're growing our internal production enormously. And if the Keystone Pipeline gets approved, then we'll take the lid off expanding the Alberta oil sands, which means access to virtually infinite supplies of oil. So North America could become energy self-sufficient by the year 2018, and that would and so the prices, frankly, we don't need $110 oil to make all these projects economic. So oil prices, in my view, should be sideways probably, and nat gas prices. Well, we've had this great winter, but I think we're going to have more cold winters too. That's another story. So oil and gas are attractive areas in it because the market isn't paying in the multiples that they should for the earnings there because they're not convinced they're going to last. We go on to the base metals, and frankly, that's a China story, and I am concerned that China is going to be dragged into doing something untoward. They've been loading up on iron ore and copper, buying more than they needed when they had the renminbi at an all-time high in price. They've let the renminbi suddenly drop in price. What worries me is that that means that they think they've got enough on hand to withstand any small-scale interdiction by the Seventh Fleet. So the base metals area is attractive, but not wildly attractive. In agriculture, the prices got hammered down by the great crops, but now we have drought in Brazil, and the production is going to be well below forecast there. We have a really amazing situation unfolding. The upper Great Lakes are frozen over. According to the Navy, this is a record level of ice on the Great Lakes. Well, what that means is when the spring thaw comes, is that we're going to have pressure from water, instead of these streams flowing into the Great Lakes, they're going to be backed up. And we also have snow on the grounds on the upper Midwest. So the albedo effect is at work, which means sunlight, when it does come out, is being reflected back into space. So what I think now is we have risks of severe floods in the upper Midwest. And then we, of course, have the Putin effect in Ukraine. So the grain prices, which got driven down to really low levels, we're turning bullish on those. And as far as gold and silver are concerned, I believe I turned bullish on them early in January because I believe that they had bottomed out, that the speculators had made such a fortune. And also the effect that I had been watching for, which was that the sell-offs were always occurring on the weekends. That's where they were. So you come into work in the morning on Monday and you'd find gold and silver were down, and not much would happen during the week. That was being done because the speculators could trade their futures markets in the thin markets of Singapore and Hong Kong and hammer down the prices. Well, that game is pretty much over. And what we see is the Chinese have been buying vast quantities of gold. The Indians, when they can, are getting more. So we've got real people buying bullion, and the speculators who made money out of paper shorting have got given to sidelines, so we've taken that off it. And now we have geopolitical risk coming in. So my view is that we've had a nice rally off the low. We're at about 1340 gold now. And this starts to get to the level where more and more gold mines, once again, are profitable. They got devastated because there's not a gold mine of any size in the world that would be profitable at $1,000 gold now, because they've opened new mines with minute grades, less than 1 gram per ton. So they need higher prices. So if you look at what's happened on a year-to-date basis, you can see how it's coming in, because gold is up 11%, and the gold stock index is up 25%, but the GDXJ, which is the junior one, is up 36.5%, which means that belief is returning.
Right. Right. Well, they were certainly, you know, the concern was, of course, if this kept going, that you just have to see a lot of mines shut down.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No question about it. So it was a near-run thing, as Wellington said, of Waterloo. And we really got to just about that level last October.
Well, before we close, I just want to thank you again. As I always say, you can connect everything with everything.
Well, look, thank you so much. I've rarely had an interview which has been as much fun for me, so thank you for the invitation.
Well, I just want to, before I close, I want to underscore again that you've created the new strategy service, and people can learn more at coxadvisor.net. Anything else you want to say about the new strategy service? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was .net. .com, coxadvisor.com. Mm-hmm. Do you have it set up for both? Because I was at coxadvisor.net this morning. I think it...
Oh, well, maybe that works too, but our fish...
Yeah, your webmaster may be smarter than you know. anything else you want to say about the strategy service? Because I know that it's been...
I was for 2 decades the global portfolio strategist for the BMO Bank of Montreal Financial Group, and I retired from that job, and we've just been advising on commodity stock portfolios, which are Bank of Montreal products, and we've opened up this new strategy service, which continues what I did for 2 decades for them, which was publishing a strategy journal, and which developed a fair following. And so this is not just about commodities, as you can tell with the questions and everything. I'm interested. I'm an historian by training and development, and a bit of a classic scholar. So I love long-term themes. That's what I'm good at. So when I see something long unfolding, what I want to see is that the pieces are in place for it. And so that's what the strategy journal aims at, is for serious long-term investors. It's not aimed at short-term traders.
Well, I will say this. Every time I get corruption and war weary, I read one of your pieces, and I get all inspired to solve the real problems before us. So I can't thank you enough for your work, Don.
Bless you.
You have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you.